Revelation 13, then. Let's hear God's word together. And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him?" The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies, and to exercise his authority for 42 months. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them, and he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all those whose names have not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast, or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. What if this present were the world's last night? That question, posed originally in a sonnet by one of the metaphysical poets, has been the theme of our studies these last few Sunday evenings. Suppose the world did end tomorrow. Would we have any inkling of that tonight? On the one hand, the Bible's answer to that is an emphatic no. When Christ returns at the end of the age, says the New Testament, as he surely will do, no one will have worked it out in advance. His coming will be sudden and unexpected. But on the other hand, the Bible, in a number of passages, does paint for us a description, in general terms, of what the world will be like in the last days, as the Bible calls it. And no New Testament book has got more interest in providing us with such an anticipatory picture than the book of Revelation. Now, it has to be said, some people go rather over the top with the book of Revelation. They treat it as if it were an account given to us in advance of precise and detailed events which will occur in the last few years of world history. I might as well be frank and tell you right at the outset that I don't take that view myself of this book. I think it's far better understood as offering albeit in symbolic form, a picture of the general pattern of things throughout the whole of church history. The last days stretching from the time when Jesus ascended to glory after his resurrection, right through until his second coming. If you take the view that the book of Revelation is only interested in the very last few years before Jesus returns, it means it was a book of no real relevance to John's original contemporaries for whom he wrote it, or indeed for anybody in the last 2,000 years of history. It might conceivably be of relevance to us if Jesus were coming in the next few years, but if he isn't, it's no use to us much either. It's very strange for God to have given a book which is of so little use to the church. Now, this is a book which is relevant to all Christians in all ages. It has to be. All the New Testament is like that. So the pictures it paints are relevant to every Christian in every age. And whatever interpretation we find of this chapter, Revelation 13, we're going to read, that we have read and are going to look at tonight, it has to be consistent with that general principle of relevance to the church. What is then Revelation 13 about? Well, Revelation 13 is telling us that one aspect of the last days will be the demonization of politics. That's what this chapter claims. One aspect of the last days will be the demonization of politics. That's what this beast represents. I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. Now, if you were paying attention earlier, you would have noticed that reading from the book of Romans that we had. The Apostle Paul tells us in Romans chapter 13 that the proper function of government is to reflect the just rule of God within society. There's nothing essentially dirty about politics. For goodness sake, don't run away with that idea. It's perfectly possible for political power to be exercised in a way that pleases God. That's what Romans 13 says. It is God himself who has instituted civil authority, says the apostle, in order that his moral law might be maintained in this fallen world. Government, says Paul, is God's servant for the good of all men. That's how it's meant to be, anyway. Indeed, that's how it proved to be often, in Paul's early experience, certainly. On several occasions, the Apostle Paul was rescued from the mob, you may remember, or from false accusations by his Jewish opponents, because of the timely intervention of Roman justice. But Paul himself knew that this happy situation would not last forever. In another of his letters, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, he himself speaks of a rebellion or an anarchy that is coming, a man of anarchy who will set himself up against God and his people before the end comes. And in this passage in Revelation, John is simply describing for us, within the apocalyptic symbolism which he conventionally uses, another picture of this personification of demonic, anti-Christian tyranny, which Paul anticipated in rather more prosaic terms in that chapter in Thessalonians. This is what the early church often called the Antichrist. See how he's described in verse 2. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. A strange zoological hybrid, then. John's bizarre imagery isn't so much to be visualized as to be decoded. Back in the Old Testament, Daniel was given a vision, not of one beast coming out of the sea, but 4 beasts. The first was like a lion, the second was like a bear, the third was like a leopard, and the fourth, we're told, was a hideously powerful carnivore, unlike any beast Daniel knew. But it seems that those four beasts represented in Daniel are successive world empires. We're in fact told that in the book of Daniel. There's some speculation about exactly which world empires are represented, but maybe the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman, say. And what John seems to have done in the case of his beast is to fuse these 4 symbolic animals of Daniel chapter 7 together to make one, as it were, composite monster. A bit like a trade union congress motion, you know, a composite. The sum total of all the tyrannies the world has known, pushed together in one rather unattractive and rather difficult to imagine whole. Now, I suspect that for John's contemporaries, they had no difficulty in identifying who this beast was as far as they were concerned. He represented Rome, the anti-Christian tyranny that was persecuting them right then and there. If you'd asked a Christian in the Middle Ages who the beast represented, it's very likely they would have said Islam. For in those days when Islam was sweeping through North Africa and the Middle East and even parts of Spain, many Christians felt this was a great anti-Christian demonic force that was threatening Christian civilization, the Antichrist. If you'd asked a Lutheran at the time of the Reformation what the Antichrist represented, they would have said the Roman Catholic Church. For in those days, it was the institutional church that seemed to be persecuting true believers. And of course, if you'd asked many Christians a few years ago, before the fall of the Iron Curtain, they would have said the Antichrist represented communism. If you asked some today, they would probably say the European Community. Well, leaving aside the European Community for a moment, perhaps the truth is that the Antichrist is all these and more. The beast here is the archetype of godless politics in every age. Wherever politics takes on a demonic hue, there is the Antichrist. There is the beast. Notice whose image he bears. 10 horns and 7 heads. Now, if you look back to chapter 12, you will find that that is exactly the appearance of the dragon. A dragon whom John himself identifies in 12 verse 9 as the devil or Satan. Indeed, it is that very same dragon, the devil, who stands on the seashore at the very end of chapter 12 and beckons this infernal colleague of his up from the abyss. And it's that very same dragon, we read in verse 2, who empowers this beast with the authority he wields. So you see, the beast is government, all right. These horns and crowns symbolize great power and authority in the world. But it is not government reflecting the just rule of a sovereign God, a la Romans 13. What we have here in Revelation 13 is government in its demonic perversion. This is what government becomes when the devil gets his hands on it. Evil incarnate in structures of political power, earthly manifestations of heavenly principalities and powers with which the Christian must wrestle. Notice John provides us here with three characteristics by which this beast can be recognized. First, invincibility. Verse 3. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. In other words, this beast seems to have an uncanny way of re-emerging when you think you've beaten him. He seemed to have received a fatal wound, but here he is back again. To the Christians in the first century, I think it's just possible this may have called to mind the myth that Nero had never really committed suicide and would one day return. A bit like, you know, the myth about Hitler coming back or living in anonymity somewhere. They had a similar kind of belief about Nero. Certainly in the experience of the church, it must have seemed that they had lost one persecuting empire, only to find another. Nero had been a terrible guy, but Domitian, by the end of the first century, was persecuting even more Christians, perhaps, than Nero ever did. So the suffering of the church was going on. To us in the 20th century, it's perhaps a sobering commentary on the way that revolution by violence so rarely seems to result in real freedom. So often all revolution produces is a worse tyranny than the one it was intended to overthrow. Don't you notice that? And we lose the Tsar and gain a Lenin. We lose the Kaiser and gain a Hitler. We lose colonial oppression and gain communist oppression. In his book Darkness at Noon, Arthur Koestler relates the story of an old Bolshevik who fought the good fight of Marxism, only to find himself arrested as an enemy of the people. The beast is wounded, but always seems to be healed. He has this demonic recuperative power, you see. I suppose what John is really saying is, you can't defeat this beast by force of arms. At best, all you can achieve by violence is a brief respite from his tyranny. But he'll be back again. That fatal wound you thought you had inflicted will be healed. He'll be back again, uglier than ever. That's the first characteristic of him, then. Invincibility. The second, popularity. Well, this is strange, perhaps, and unexpected. Verse 3, the whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he'd given authority to the beast, and they also worshipped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? Now, I suppose there is no greater political mirage than that illusion that somehow democracy is a cast iron barrier against the abuse of power. We all like to believe that's so. I wish it were so, but unfortunately it isn't. You can't fool all the people all the time, said Lincoln. Well, I think he underestimated the beast. People are not as astute or as upright as our democratic idealism would have us believe. People are quite capable of voting the beast into office, says John. In fact, of course, they voted Hitler into office. I assume you know that. One of the astonishing ironies of our 20th century is the way in which our obsession with elections has legitimized the rule of tyrannical individuals and tyrannical parties who thereafter dignify their regimes with the title democratic republics. And the fact is, people, fallen people, admire might more than righteousness. Who can make war against him? The beast is impressive. And simple-minded folk are easily swayed by his power and his rhetoric. We will gladly worship Satan and his allies, it seems, in exchange for military security. More concerned to save their skins always than to save their souls. This is what human beings are like. Popularity, then. Unexpected, but that, says John, is another feature of the beast. But the most important characteristic of all is the third. Totalitarianism. Look again at that word that occurs in verse 4 and again in verse 8. They worshipped the beast. All inhabitants of the earth, verse 8, will worship the beast. I want you to notice that word very carefully, for it is the most important clue to this beast's identity. Governments can, of course, be militarily powerful and can, of course, be popular without being demonic. Those earlier two characteristics are not absolutely definitive in any way. The characteristic, though, that really gives the beast away is the attitude of total obedience, total allegiance, which he demands from his citizens. He is not satisfied that men fear God and honor the king. He wants total and unconditional submission of the will. In a word, he wants worship. And that's what I mean by totalitarianism. It's possible, in my view, you know, to distinguish two quite distinct theories of government throughout history. On the one hand, there's what often is called constitutional government, the constitutional model. On that view of the state, the government exists, or the state exists, to serve the interests of the individual. Very often, a constitution is written defining the rights of individuals which the state must defend, and which it can never, in the nature of things, contradict, limiting the power of government. Such a government feels itself to be accountable to some higher law than itself. That's what the Constitution represents. It's an expression of that higher law over the top of government, to which government itself is accountable. It cannot make, then, arbitrary decrees. It can only govern in accordance with those absolute principles of justice enshrined in the Constitution. But on the other hand, there is the totalitarian model of government. Again, something which has featured much in the history of modern Europe. On this view, each citizen abdicates their individualistic goals and rights for the superior good of society as a whole. On this view, the state is seen as a kind of living organism with a will of its own, the general will, as Rousseau called it. A will which legitimately overrules the private consciences of individuals within it. That kind of government sees itself as an absolute, above the law, accountable to no one but itself. To give you a concrete example, here's a quote from Mussolini. Fascism conceives of the state as an absolute in comparison with which all individuals or groups are relative. Or this quote from Hans Frank. Our constitution, he says, is the will of the Führer. That's totalitarianism. Citizens of such a state may perform any kind of atrocity and yet consider themselves immune from moral responsibility because they are simply following government orders, like limbs of a body, unquestioningly performing the dictates of the head. That's exactly what we saw at the Nuremberg trials, when the Nazis were held to account for what they had done. There was really a collision of ideology there, what the state is meant to be. The moral blindness of those folk, so many of them, was written down to this totalitarian view of what the state is. At the risk of oversimplifying things, I'm prepared to argue that those two types of government, the constitutional and the totalitarian, represent in political theory broadly what Romans 13 and Revelation 13 represent in the biblical theology of politics. Government as God wills it, an accountable institution to a higher law, namely God, or government as Satan perverts it, a deified state that wants to be absolute in power itself. The archetypal example of the totalitarian state in the Old Testament, I guess, was Egypt, where the will of Pharaoh was obeyed as if it was the will of God, and of course God's people were enslaved as a result. The archetypal model of constitutional government in the Old Testament is Israel, with its king, who, at least according to the book of Deuteronomy, could make no laws of his own. All he could do was enforce the national constitution of which he was the custodian, the law of God. So according to the Bible, you see, it's not a question, as we sometimes in history perceived it, as monarchy versus democracy, or privileged elites versus the universal franchise. The way in which a political leader or a political party is selected for government is really of minor importance. The vital thing is how political leadership is perceived, both by itself and by the people. That's the key thing you have to ask. The mark of the beast is that he demands to be worshipped. Absolute political power, answerable to no one but itself, the deified state. Notice what we're told about this in verses 5 and 6. This beast, this totalitarian beast, was given a mouth to utter proud words. Well, that figures, doesn't it? And blasphemies, yes, of course, because he was arrogating to himself divine status. And to exercise his authority for 42 months. Now that's a kind of oblique reference, again, back to the book of Daniel. For one of the figures of history that very much fitted into this anti-Christ mold was a guy called Antiochus Epiphanes, who came before Jesus and caused havoc to the Jewish people by his tyranny and his brutality to the people of God. This period of 42 months is, in the book of Daniel, a kind of stands for the brief interlude of time in which God would give this awful man freedom to carry out his atrocities. But John here, you see, although he knows he comes many years after Antiochus Epiphanes, sees this Antichrist resurrected in his day in the Roman Empire. Julius Caesar abolished the republican constitution of Rome and made the Roman Empire into an absolute dictatorship. And the emperors that followed from him increasingly arrogated to themselves divine titles and prerogatives. Domitian, who very likely was emperor at the time when the book of Revelation was written, went so far as to demand that people address him as Dominus et Deus, Lord and God. No wonder John speaks of the beast uttering proud words and blasphemies. It's important for us, though, to realize that the beast does not have to use explicit religious language in order to give expression to this deification of political power which he represents. So long as the obedience he receives is unquestioning and unconditional, as long as his authority is absolute, acknowledging no constitutional limits, then the particular titles he arrogates to himself are really irrelevant. He's playing God. And the people are worshipping him, whether they use that religious language of it or not. I suppose the question we want to ask is, how on earth do people fall for it? I mean, surely this kind of tyrannical system can only be sustained by coercion. But as we've already said, John is shrewd enough to realize that isn't so. People voluntarily submit to the beast's authority in their masses. And I guess no one who has seen the archive films of those adulating crowds before Hitler in the 1930s can have any doubt of the accuracy of John's perception in this matter. How is it done? How does the beast achieve this astonishing PR exercise? That's the significance of the last paragraph of the chapter, from verse 11 onwards. The beast out of the earth. Look at that now. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb. Notice that. His appearance is different from the first beast. But he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast. Notice that. This is the instrument by which the people are wooed to the worship, to the allegiance of this beast. Now, if you look on to chapter 19, verse 20, just briefly if you want to, you'll find this second beast is also given another title. He's called the false prophet. And that's an important clue, I think, to his identity. For if the beast from the sea represents the totalitarian state, then the beast of the earth represents the state religion or the state ideology that bolsters that regime and persuades people to yield their allegiance to it. Now, I have no doubt personally that to John's contemporaries, this referred to the paraphernalia of the emperor cult. There was a whole religion in the second half of the first century dedicated to the worship of the emperor with impressive ceremonial and pagan hocus-pocus. Of course, a later generation of Protestant martyrs would identify this beast of the earth with the papacy, with the Roman Catholic system, which kept the Pope in this unparalleled position of political influence and, from their point of view, danger to the Christian Church. For us today, maybe this beast out of the earth is a bit more difficult to identify. Where is the emperor worship? Where is the religion? Where is the ideology that persuades people to worship the beast today? We've tried, of course, very hard to sever religion and politics in recent years, haven't we? It was our desire for toleration that motivated that in the last 200 or 300 years. We've realized that you can only really maintain peace if you keep religion out of politics, and so we've tried. In America, they excluded religion from politics, as it were, by law, in the Constitution. In England, a sentimental attachment to tradition led us to retain the established church, but with a typical British compromise, we made sure the bishops were consigned to a convenient corner of political impotence called the House of Lords. But either way, what has emerged, whether in America or in Britain, or indeed anywhere in the West in the last 200 years, is the secular state. Politics with no religious banner to wave. At least that's what it's supposed to be. But if you think about it, what has actually happened, of course, is not that religion has been banished from politics, but that a new, godless, secularized religion has grown up to inform the political enterprise instead. Humanism, capitalism, socialism, Marxism, fascism. Many, many, many isms of that sort have emerged in the last 200 or 300 years to inform the political process. These systems of thought may not use religious terminology, but where they assume ideological proportions, they begin to fulfill religious functions in people's lives. They begin to provide people with a comprehensive worldview and value system. And all too often, they have become the 20th century ideological counterparts of the official Roman religion of John's day. These are the philosophies by which the false prophets of totalitarianism in our century have sought to rationalize their authoritarian regimes. John gives us again some interesting insights into the kind of techniques which this kind of ideology uses. For a start, in verse 11, he says, it always projects a deceptive public image. He had two horns like a lamb. In other words, he looked harmless and respectable on the outside. It was what he actually said that was pernicious. But of course, we human beings so often are taken in by appearances, aren't we? There are quite a number of books on the shelves of Cambridge University Library that fall into this category, you know. The ideology of the beast always has a front man who is so plausible and charming and erudite and respectable. Probably has a Cambridge University lectureship. A propaganda campaign, that's another tool of this kind of ideology of the beast. Look at verse 13. He performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. And because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. Magic, of one kind or another, whether real or pretended, was part of the stuff of religion in the first century. Conjuring tricks or real displays of demonic supernaturalism may well have been performed in the context of the emperor cult. And no doubt it impressed an unsophisticated age. In a world like ours, perhaps, where supernaturalism tends to be rather more disdained, maybe it's the miracles of modern technology that will take the place of these. But the purpose is the same. To convince the general public that the beast can deliver the goods. By carefully staged advertising stunts to convince the world the beast can solve the energy crisis. The beast can revive the economy. Vote for the beast! A propaganda campaign. That's his second instrument. And the third, interestingly, a cult of personality. Look again at verse 14 and 15. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak. Now, this is one of the most fascinating and universal features of totalitarian government wherever you encounter it. It always needs a face. Most people can't worship a political theory. Only a very tiny subset of intellectuals get turned on by political theories. When a political party wants to gain total and unconditional obeisance from a whole people, it has to have a charismatic leader. Now, in the Roman Empire, of course, the way they popularized that was by making statues of the emperor. You couldn't go anywhere on a street in the Roman Empire without coming across a statue or a bust of the emperor. They put them all over the place. Now, of course, more recently, those sorts of rather hardly won, chiseled out pieces of stone have been replaced by much quicker to produce gigantic wall posters, haven't they? Saw them during the Second World War. We've seen them in Stalinist Russia, and of course we've seen them in Maoist China too, plastered all over the place. Wall posters. What's on the wall poster? The face of the leader. Worship the beast. Nowadays, of course, paper advertising is old hat. It's the television age, isn't it? Haven't you noticed how suddenly important it has become that the leader is good on the box? I mean, if he can't perform well on the box, no matter how photogenic his photograph may be, if he can't perform well on the box, he's just not electable. Because the personality cult is so embedded in us. Never before has false prophecy achieved such intimate and effective methods of propagating the personality cult of the beast within our very living rooms. He comes alive and speaks to us. But of course, there are always, for the obdurate who will not submit to such propaganda or such brainwashing, there are always the more old-fashioned techniques still available. Cruder, but effective. There's the reign of terror, for instance, in verse 15. He caused all who refused to worship the image to be killed. Once failure to conform to political orthodoxy becomes a capital offence, you really know the beast is in the driving seat. Or there's the starve them into submission technique, verse 16. He forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell, notice that, unless he had the mark. Perhaps of all the characteristics of the ideology of the beast, this is the most disconcerting to us, because of course John is describing here bureaucratic control of the economy. The beast not only holds the reins of political and military power, he monopolizes the marketplace too. You cannot buy or sell without a license from the beast. Sometimes I worry that socialists, and I mean good-intentioned and honest and even Christian socialists, are fully aware of just what a political beast they may be producing when they seek to centralize economic power too much. But then I worry too whether capitalists realize what a beast they might be creating when they merge and take over and monopolize their marketplace with their huge corporations. And I wonder if modern governments realize what a beast they may be producing with their computer systems, registering everybody by their social security numbers and their income tax numbers and the like. The opportunity for bureaucratic control of people is becoming more and more sinister, it seems to me. No one may buy or sell without the mark of the beast. See, we're not talking here necessarily, then, are we, about something remote from our experience. We don't have to look to fascist Germany or Marxist Russia for some disturbing evidence of this kind of thing. Maybe we're talking about how the beast turns men into pawns of economic planning or his scientific theories of management and the like. Maybe Leviathan is growing even within our structures, our famous and trusted structures of constitutional government. Maybe what we're talking about here is the dehumanizing tyranny of capitalistic big business politics. Or maybe what we're talking about is the paternalistic tyranny of socialistic big brother politics. Don't jump to the conclusion that what we're talking about here is something very remote from us. It is the cunning subtlety of the false prophet that makes us think it's all the other people in the world who are victims of the beast. But we are immune. Indeed, I was in my worst nightmares, you know. I sometimes imagine the beast being voted into power by the moral majority. That would be an irony that would please Satan, wouldn't it? To have Christians vote the beast into power, only to rue the day. But they could, you know. Because the ideology of totalitarianism can be very appealing to morally minded Christians. Particularly fundamentalist Calvinists. If you don't believe that, just think about the history of South Africa in recent days. Think of the role of the Reformed Church there. Now, don't jump to the conclusion that godless politics only exists in the Eastern Bloc or in Islamic countries or in the Third World. The beast may be closer than we think. This false ideology that persuades people to his right to rule may be far more impregnated into our minds than we're prepared to admit. What must be a Christian's response when the beast takes power? What should we Christians do about it? How do we react? This was, of course, a question that faced those early Christians in John's day very directly. For they were the subject of a cruel, totalitarian, and anti-Christian tyranny. And that, of course, is the relevance of that middle paragraph that we haven't looked at so far. Verse 7. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. He was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. The language John is using here, quite deliberately, echoes some of the language which he has applied to the sovereign Jesus in earlier chapters. It is Jesus who, he's told us, will reign over every language and tribe and people and nation, that all will worship him. This beast, you see, is a parody of the Lamb who really should be seated on the throne, and indeed who is seated on the throne to the eye of faith. But here on earth, in these last days, this demonic parody of the Lamb has seized that power, usurping it from the Lamb. And the result, of course, is a huge spiritual collision between those who belong to the Lamb and those who don't. I mentioned earlier that one of the characteristics of the West in the last couple of centuries has been an attempt to separate religion and politics, often in the name of toleration. And most of us, I guess, have imbibed that idea of keeping religion and politics apart with our mother's milk. We find it rather unenlightened and reactionary to make a political issue of our religious preferences. We must just live and let live, we say. Well, I have to tell you, it can't be quite as straightforward as that. It would be very convenient to keep religion and politics in watertight compartments. Indeed, it might very well be safer to do that. Some religions may be content with such an arrangement. But I don't believe New Testament Christianity can acquiesce to it. And the reason for that is quite simple. The fundamental creed, the fundamental tenet of a Christian's faith is this: Jesus Christ is Lord. Not just Jesus Christ is my Lord, as if his dominion were restricted to the private life of a Christian believer. Now, our confession is Jesus Christ is Lord. He is the Lamb on the throne, the unqualified and universal legitimate King of everything and everybody. If men and women are ignorant of his rule, they must be told. That's evangelism. That's why we have the right to tell the world about Jesus, because he is king. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, he says. Go therefore. Without that confession, Jesus Christ is Lord, our evangelism would be a most impudent intrusion into other people's lives. But no. Jesus Christ is Lord. If they're ignorant of his rule, they must be told. That is evangelism. If they reject his rule, they will face the consequences. That is judgment. Now, I suggest to you, a creed like that has to have political implications. The Roman Empire was quite right, in my view, to treat Christianity as a treasonable offence. The Kremlin, in my view, was quite right to be anxious about the growing number of Baptist and Pentecostal believers in Russia before the fall of the Soviet Empire. I think the regime in China is quite right to be antagonistic to the church in that country, given the kind of regime China currently wants to prevail there. Not because Christians have got any political program or military muscle, we have none. But simply because our confession, Jesus Christ is Lord, exposes to public gaze the illegitimacy of the beast. We are saying, there is a sovereign to whom the state is accountable. That is the truth which the liar fears. There is a greater allegiance. There is a greater authority. The state has a legitimate claim upon our lives. The New Testament tells us so. We are to honor the king. We are to obey the authorities. But we cannot give to the authorities that unconditional and absolute allegiance which the beast demands. That belongs only to Jesus. For Jesus Christ is Lord. There is then no way Christianity can ever surrender to totalitarianism without denying to Christ that proper authority in the civil sphere which our confession of his sovereignty demands. And that, of course, is why the Roman Empire persecuted the Christians. Because they would keep on saying, Jesus Christ is Lord, and refused, therefore, to say, Caesar is Lord. They knew what Caesar was claiming by that confession, and they would not say it. This is why the beast always finishes persecuting the church. If Christianity were a religion that could keep its nose out of politics, it would be safe, but it can't. Authentic Christianity is politically aware. Though others may surrender their will to the totalitarian state, the Christian can't. Because the Christian knows the rule of the beast is illegitimate. He is a usurper of a throne that doesn't belong to him. Belongs to Jesus. Oddly enough, I think that that is the significance of this cryptic number 666. I'm sure you've been waiting for me to get round to that. Enormous quantities of ink, of course, have been spilt trying to look at what that means. Most have assumed that it's an example of what's called gematria. The Greeks didn't have separate numerals distinct from the letters of their alphabet. They used alphabetic letters for numbers. And that means that you can add up, as it were, a numerical value for any Greek word, assigning the numeric value to the letters. This was a very popular game in the ancient world called gematria, and it was particularly popular amongst people familiar with apocalyptic writing. One piece of graffiti that has actually turned up in Pompeii, scribed on a wall somewhere, is this. I love her whose number is 545. Isn't that romantic? You see, all the young ladies in Pompeii sort of working out the number of their names and all their friends' names to see who is this lucky girl who has a secret lover. Much more romantic than just carving your initials on an oak tree. Much more intriguing. Well, is 666 some similar cryptic representation of somebody's name? The name of Nero, perhaps. It would be nice if that worked. Unfortunately, you can only make it work by translating Nero's titles into Hebrew and making a spelling mistake. So that's not terribly convincing. My opinion, and it's only an opinion, I stress, for what it's worth, is that this isn't true gematria at all, though it's related to it. This is a symbolic number. You see, according to gematria, the name of Jesus comes to 888. There's actually an apocalyptic book that we have access to from the early centuries that comments on this. It wouldn't be at all surprising, I think, if 888 were not a quite well-known code number for Jesus within the circle of John's persecuted friends. Persecuted people tend to like to use codes. It's less politically inflammatory. And if so, well then perhaps the number of the beast, 666, is simply a comment to those in the know on the inferiority of the beast to Jesus. He pretends to be the Christ. He is the Antichrist. He assumes the prerogatives that only belong to Jesus, but he's not 888. He's 666, the number of a man. Don't forget it. He may call himself Lord, but he is just a man. It's a kind of arithmetic way of blowing a raspberry at the beast, you see. Well, that's my theory anyway. Whether it's right or not, I haven't the foggiest notion. But what I can tell you is that John, in writing this chapter, is certainly trying to make Christians aware of the spiritual implications of any concession they make to this totalitarian, imperialistic regime of the beast, which was ruling the roost in their day. He's telling them, You have a responsibility as a Christian to make your stand against the beast. You may not wear his mark. It would be convenient to separate religion from politics and to restrict your Christianity to your private life. But you can't do that. It doesn't work. You must identify yourself not as one who wears the mark of the beast, but as one who bears the seal of God's chosen. Those who belong to the Lamb and whose names are written in his book of life. How are they to do that? Well, notice how they're not to do that. Nothing that John says here suggests that the church is to take up arms against the Roman emperor. Indeed, I think it's very possible that verse 10, the second half of verse 10, is saying that. One reading of the Greek text there would say, if anyone kills with the sword he will be killed. Which is certainly a quote from Jesus himself, who insisted upon non-violence amongst his disciples just before the cross. But if the church isn't to take up arms against the beast, what is she to do? Well, the answer of John to that is a very tough one. The church, he says, is to suffer. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. For you see, refusal to submit to the beast inevitably leads to civil disobedience. In the Roman Empire, to fail to worship the emperor was a treasonable offence. There are, you see, times in history when the only place a Christian can retain his or her integrity is either in prison or on the scaffold. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. And it is, says John, by patiently enduring that punishment in faithfulness to Christ that the church must make her stand. Now, I want you to notice this is not a pacifist ploy. This is not a piece of moral blackmail like an IRA hunger strike. The suffering of the church is not a manipulative political strategy. It is a spiritual witness to Christ. And yet I think it has to be said that throughout history, whenever the church has been willing to make such a costly stand, life has been made very hard for the beast. Though it does take nerve, it calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. I guess if we're honest, there has never been in our century a more embarrassing failure on the part of the church in this respect than that exhibited by the churches of Germany in the days of Hitler's rise to power. They were conspicuously silent. Why did they allow themselves to be compromised by this rising fascist tide? The Church of Luther had resisted the tyranny of the Pope. Why did it capitulate to the tyranny of Nazism? Well, the answer, I'm afraid, lies in the fact that Christianity in Europe, between the wars, and in Germany in particular, was suffering from a disastrous failure of nerve. Those who had a real experience of Christ had many of them degenerated into a mere orgy of religious sentimentality. Pietism, as it was called. Many others had lost a real faith in Christ at all, and the divine authority of the Bible had been eroded by critical theories. They no longer really believed much. At best, Christianity in Germany in the 1930s had retreated, as I say, into pietism, and at worst it had surrendered to skepticism. It was not the virile, red-blooded Christianity of the early church that cooperated so meekly with the Nazis, but an emasculated and anemic weakling. And I find many of my Christian friends from Germany recognize it, sir. and are both ashamed and repentant of the failure of the church in those critical years. But it ill behoves us to be complacent. Could it happen again, do you think? I mean, in the West, in Europe, even in Britain, could the beast take power under our noses? It would be a dangerous thing to assume he couldn't. So many of us Christians, we evangelicals these days, just like I'm afraid some Christians in Germany in the 1930s, are retreating into pietism. We bury our heads in the sand like an ostrich, or perhaps more likely in our chorus books. And we sing our hearts out about how sovereign Jesus is. Philpot Curran made that famous assertion, "The condition upon which God has given liberty to men is eternal vigilance," he said. "Which condition, if they break, slavery is both the consequence of their crime and its punishment." It's unnerving, isn't it, to think that between Paul's writing of Romans 13 and John's writing of Revelation 13, there is perhaps at the very most 4 decades. That's how quickly the political tide can turn. That's how quickly a situation of government as God wants it to be can turn into government as the devil seizes it and makes it his own. Don't be complacent then. There'll be an election, I imagine, within the coming 12 months in this country. Maybe a little longer. I hope you're thinking about the issues involved. The Bible does not assess politics in categories of right or left, Republican or Democrat, conservative or socialist. No equivalent to those terms can be found. But it does assess politics, nevertheless. It assesses politics as either with God or against him. Either accountable to a moral law way above all human beings that resides in our Creator, or accountable only to itself. When the time of that election comes, we Christians ought to be asking some shrewd questions of those who want to govern our land. Let's pray together.